Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this glorious planet. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is a gentleman that is very well known in our genre, and he's very well known here as well in our audience, Lloyd Pye. Lloyd, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kevin. I'm glad to be with you.
I've lived outside of this country and traveled outside of this country quite a lot. And it is true that in many of the countries beyond our borders, people are more open. And, you know, even the press sometimes, even the media, is a bit more open and less chuckly about it.
It's true. I mean, we sort of set ourselves up as, you know, masters of the world, rulers of everyone and everything, and everyone should see things and think things the way we do, and we have a way of trying to inflict that on everyone, including those within our own borders. So, and the most conservative elements tend to rule because they tend to be the loudest and the most vociferous and the most demanding that things be done their way, and that includes science. And The most conservative voices of science rule that roost, just like the most conservative politicians, the most conservative everything get the attention because they simply demand it.
I would like for all of us in the audience, though, to keep in mind that when we use the term conservative as applied to science, in some minds, people would think, well, that's really good, and there are cases where perhaps that is. But remember, these are the folks who at one time said the Earth was flat.
Well, you know, what you have to understand is that, I mean, I see it a little different than that. The people who were saying the world is flat at the time were religion. They were not scientists. They were religion. And religion ruled the roost of community thought for a couple centuries.
Well, let's use a different example.
I mean, excuse me, a couple centuries, sorry, a couple of millennia. What happened was the original scientists, were people who are like we are now, Kevin, those who were outliers, those who were not part of the mainstream, those who were the I honestly believe that if the same rules were still in effect as were then, you'd be dead, I'd be dead, you know, we wouldn't have made it this far, or we'd have just shut up and lived with it. I mean, they would do away with this if they could.
Well, let me use a different example then. It was the conservative scientists, the medical doctors, and other types of scientists who laughed at the idea of germs at one point.
Absolutely. You know, every breakthrough, Kevin, goes over the screaming, clawing, dead bodies of the conservatives who don't want things to change. I mean, that is what being a conservative pretty much is all about. It's trying to maintain things the way they are and be resistant to change. And, you know, they get a grip on what the reality is at some point in time, and that's their point in time. They just want it to be that way forever. They don't want change. So when I say conservative in science, it's exactly as you say. It's those who are resistant to the idea that a germ might actually cause disease, or, you know, but it isn't just science, medical science. It's geology.
It's all of it.
Anthropology. It's all of it. I mean, you know, when Alfred Wegener in 1915 wrote a book proving, I mean, beyond a shadow of a doubt, proving that at some point in time, the Americas and Africa and Europe had all been fused together. He showed how the mountains on one side were exactly the same as the mountains on the other side, how the rivers on one side were exactly the same extensions of rivers on the other side, how the freshwater fish in the rivers were the same on one side as the other, and And it just was absolutely clear as a bell to anybody with a reasonable speck of scientific curiosity about them. They could see that it was true. The one thing Wegener didn't have was a mechanism for how the ocean had come in between. But he had the facts that they were together. They should have started building on that and tried to figure it out. But no, they didn't want to do that. You know, the Earth's unstable. Are you kidding? Darwin had just proved that, you know, biology wasn't stable. They weren't about to deal with that. And so, you know, forget Wegener for 50 years. But, I mean, he had it right. Mm-hmm. But they're not really scientists in that they don't want things to change. They want it to stay the way they understand it and not have to go back to the drawing board and relearn anything. So that's where, when we talk about conservatives, that's who we're talking about. Those who don't want to move forward, those who don't want anything new to come up that shakes the, you know, shakes the catbird seat that they sit quite comfortably in.
Yes, and of course, government by its very nature is a conservative institution, even though talk about, you know, politically, this guy's liberal, that guy's conservative. Government itself is a very conservative institution. It doesn't want a lot of change happening really fast.
Exactly.
And so they fund the scientist who can help them hang on to the wall.
Right. Well, everybody is comfortable, Kevin, with incremental steps forward. Everybody's happy with incremental steps, that everybody, even the most conservative people, can inch out forward a step, or, you know, an inch or two or step or two or whatever. What everybody works to avoid is the big leap forward. The big mm-hmm. leap forward never comes from within the ranks of the mainstream. The big leaps forward in any endeavor always come from outsiders, from outside. You know, people think like, well, Einstein, he came from outside. Everybody that does really big things comes from outside. It isn't going to come from the inside, because the inside is built to maintain equilibrium, to maintain the status quo. And so it's the renegades and the heretics that are really out on the cutting edge. Science is very, very good at public relations and making people think that they are at the cutting edge, that they are just out there hacking away with their machetes, trying to find the truth of any new, you know, any new thing. We're right out there. It's so not true. It is so not true. They are all hanging back, hiding behind the skirts of those who are really out there with the machetes in hand, cutting into, out at the cutting edge and finding, you know, making the new discoveries. That's the reality of it. It's not at all like their PR portrays them.
So are you a renegade or a heretic?
I'm both. I think we all are. I don't think you'd have a show like this if you weren't. I wouldn't be doing what I do if I wasn't. There are those of us who have badly flawed sheeple genes. You know, I think, I don't know how much your listeners know about Sitchin's work, but I'm a supporter of the idea that we were genetically engineered by the Anunnaki to be a slave and a servant about 200,000 years ago. I think the evidence is overwhelming in that direction. And when they were doing that, when you make a slave and a servant, one of the things, I mean, many things you want to do to make them capable as slaves and servants, one of which is you make them really stupid compared to you, and we are, and you also insert in them a gene or some factor that makes them be obedient, docile, not questioning, go along with the crowd, follow orders, you know, that, and I just collectively call that the sheeple gene. We humans have a sheeple gene. Mm-hmm. And the 99% of us, you know, talk about the 99% and the 1% politically, well, I would think it's about the same thing. Those of us who have a pretty well-functioning sheeple gene, we go along with the program. We do what we're told. We don't make waves. We, you know, we're obedient, good slaves and servants. And then there are those rare few of us, like genetic defects are found all over the world, right? And different in different ways. And there are those of us who are born with a very, very dysfunctional sheeple gene. And we're the ones that are always pestering and questioning and doubting and not believing and making a real, you know, real pains of ourselves. And that's us. We are the ones with the faulty sheeple genes, and we wouldn't do what we do if we had a good one. So in a way, we're defective copies from what the Anunnaki would have wanted, but it's those of us with those defective copies that get things done, that make things, that break new ground, that stand out at the cutting edge, machete in hand, hacking away. That's what we do. It isn't always to our benefit. We don't always get well rewarded for that kind of attitude and that kind of lifestyle. But nonetheless, and probably in all honesty, those of us who have that would wish to be normal, to be just, you know, to not give it any thought, to just live your life, watch your TV, drink your beer, watch your games, win your bets, you know, like that, and not think about much else. But we, being what we are, and your audience wouldn't be listening if they had, you know, completely functional sheeple genes. They would just be outraged at the idea of a show like yours or work like what I do. So all of you listening, congratulations on your degree of faultiness in your sheeple gene. But that's what makes us a community. We are the ones with the faulty sheeple genes.
Now, we're going to get to the Star Child and the latest updates on that in just a moment. But let me ask you, in talking sure. about all these folks that have a defective sheeple gene, is that a good thing for society, or is that not a good thing?
Well, it depends on which side of society you're standing on. If you're in the sheeple gene, you know, functional sheeple gene crowd, we're just nothing but a pain. Why? All we're doing is pointing out the flaws in the system, the things that aren't right, things that could be better, you know, on and on. We are sand in the gears of the smooth operation of the slave, you know, the slave and servant state that humans were created to be. So in that sense, we're trouble. But from our standpoint, from our side, you need people like us. You need scolds. You need prods. You need those who force the issues of making things change, of making things happen. And so it's good and it's bad on both sides of the issue, I think. It just depends on which side you happen to be born into. And the vast, vast majority are those who are born with the functioning, well-functioning sheeple gene.
All right. Well, let's talk about something definitely non-sheeple. And that is the Star Child skull. We do have new listeners all the time, Lloyd, every night. And a number of them, a fair number of them, are not only new to the show, they are new to this whole realm of information. We've got about 2.5 minutes here before we have to take a break. Can you give us a thumbnail history of what are we talking about, this Star Child skull, and where did it come from?
The Star Child skull is a real, true bone skull. It's not a crystal skull. It is a bone skull, like your skull or my skull, that was found in Mexico at about 1930 and was recovered along with a human skull. And the person who found it assumed it was a deformity. And everyone that had possession of it up until 1998, from 1930 to 1998, believed that it was just some kind of human deformity. But it fell into the hands in late 1998 of a woman, a couple, Ray and Melanie Young of El Paso, Texas. But Melanie had been a neonatal nurse for a number of years, and she knew right away upon seeing it that it wasn't a typical human deformity. It wasn't really a deformity at all. It wasn't human as far as she could tell. It was different in so many ways as a human skull should be. It was just different everywhere. And it was too light. It was much too light. And so she thought, and also it looked like it had all the physical outlines of a gray alien. The heart-shaped face, you know, the expanded parietals at the top, the crease down the middle, the very sharpened and reduced lower face. And so she told her husband, Ray, I think this is the skull of a gray alien. And so, because they also belong to MUFON, I should mention that, Mutual UFO Network of El Paso. So you had just this incredible coincidence that the skull falls into the hands of a woman who is a neonatal nurse and belongs to MUFON. So she's knowledgeable about UFOs and she's knowledgeable about human deformity. And it's her judgment that it's not a human deformity or otherwise, and it's very likely the skull of an alien. And so that's how I got brought into it, as they began to try to determine what it was. They couldn't get any mainstream people to help them, and so they looked around in the world of alternative knowledge, and my name came up as a person who dealt with skulls in the work that I did with hominoids.
Okay. All right, we have to step away for a break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about this skull. It's called the Star Child Skull. That's just a nickname that it's been given. And the question is it human? And if it is not, what the heck is it?
Live with it. I mean, they would do away with it if they could.
Let me use a different example then. It was the conservative scientists, the medical doctors, and other types of scientists who laughed at the idea of germs at one point.
Absolutely. You know, every breakthrough, Kevin, goes over the screaming, clawing, dead bodies of the conservatives who don't want things to change. I mean, that is what being a conservative pretty much is all about. It's trying to maintain things the way they are and be resistant to change. And, you know, they get a grip on what the reality is at some point in time, and that's their point in time. They just want it to be that way forever. They don't want change. So when I say conservative in science, it's exactly as you say. It's those who are resistant to the idea that a germ might actually cause disease, or, you know, but it isn't just science, medical science. It's geology.
It's all of it.
Anthropology. It's all of it. I mean, you know, when Alfred Wegener in 1915 wrote a book proving, I mean, beyond a shadow of a doubt, proving that at some point in time, the Americas and Africa and Europe had all been fused together. He showed how the mountains on one side were exactly the same as the mountains on the other side, how the rivers on one side were exactly the same extensions of rivers on the other side, how the freshwater fish in the rivers were the same on one side as the other. And it just was absolutely clear as a bell to anybody with a reasonable speck of scientific curiosity about them. They could see that it was true. The one thing Wegener didn't have was a mechanism for how the ocean had come in between, but he had the facts that they were together. They should have started building on that and tried to figure it out, but no, they didn't want to do that. You know, the Earth's unstable. Are you kidding? Darwin had just proved that you know, biology wasn't stable. They weren't about to deal with that, and so, you know, forget Wegener for 50 years. But, I mean, he had it right, but they're not really scientists in that they don't want things to change. They want it to stay the way they understand it and not have to go back to the drawing board and relearn anything. So that's where, when we talk about conservatives, that's who we're talking about. Those who don't want to move forward, those who don't want anything new to come up that shakes the, you know, shakes the catbird seat that they sit quite comfortably in.
Yes, and of course, government by its very nature is a conservative institution, even though we talk about, you know, politically, this guy's liberal, that guy's conservative. Government itself is a very conservative institution. It doesn't want a lot of change happening really fast.
Exactly.
And so they fund the scientists who can help them hang on to the wall.
Right. Well, everybody is comfortable, Kevin, with incremental steps forward. Everybody's happy with incremental steps, that everybody, even the most conservative people, can inch out forward a step, or, you know, an inch or two or step or two or whatever. What everybody works to avoid is the big leap forward. The big leap forward never comes from within the ranks of the mainstream. The big leaps forward in any endeavor always come from outsiders, from outside. You know, people think like, well, Einstein, he came from outside. Everybody that does really big things comes from outside. It isn't going to come from the inside, because the inside is built to maintain equilibrium, to maintain the status quo. And so it's the renegades and the heretics that are really out on the cutting edge. Science is very, very good at public relations and making people think that they are at the cutting edge, that they are just out there hacking away with their machetes, trying to find the truth of any new, you know, any new thing. We're right out there. It's so not true. It is so not true. They are all hanging back, hiding behind the skirts of those who are really out there with the machetes in hand, cutting into out at the cutting edge and finding, you know, making the new discoveries. That's the reality of it. It's not at all like their PR portrays them.
So are you a renegade or a heretic?
I'm both. I think we all are. I don't think you'd have a show like this if you weren't. I wouldn't be doing what I do if I wasn't. There are those of us who have badly flawed sheeple genes. I don't know how much your listeners know about Sitchin's work, but I'm a supporter of the idea that we were genetically engineered by the Anunnaki to be a slave and a servant about 200,000 years ago. I think the evidence is overwhelming in that direction. And when they were doing that, when you make a slave and a servant, one of the things, I mean, there are many things you want to do to make them capable as slaves and servants, one of which is you make them really stupid compared to you, and we are, and you also insert in them a gene or some factor that makes them be obedient, docile, not questioning, go along with the crowd, follow orders, you know, that. And I just collectively call that the sheeple gene. We humans have a sheeple gene. Mm-hmm. And the 99% of us, you know, talk about the 99% and the 1% politically, well, I would think it's about the same thing. Those of us who have a pretty well-functioning sheeple gene, we go along with the program. We do what we're told. We don't make waves. We, you know, we're obedient, good slaves and servants. And then there are those rare few of us, like genetic defects are found all over the world, right? And different in different ways. And there are those of us who are born with a very, very dysfunctional sheeple gene. And we're the ones that are always pestering and questioning and doubting and not believing and making a real, you know, real pains of ourselves. And that's us. We are the ones with the faulty sheeple genes, and we wouldn't do what we do if we had a good one. So in a way, we're defective copies from what the Anunnaki would have wanted, but it's those of us with those defective copies that get things done, that make things, that break new ground, that stand out at the cutting edge, machete in hand, hacking away. That's what we do. It isn't always to our benefit. We don't always get well rewarded for that kind of attitude and that kind of lifestyle. But nonetheless, and probably in all honesty, those of us who have that would wish to be normal, to be just, you know, to not give it any thought, to just live your life, watch your TV, drink your beer, watch your games, win your bets, you know, like that, and not think about much else. But we, being what we are, and your audience wouldn't be listening if they had, you know, completely functional sheeple genes. They would just be outraged at the idea of a show like yours or work like what I do. So all of you listening, congratulations on your degree of faultiness in your sheeple gene. But that's what makes us a community. We are the ones with the faulty sheeple genes.
Now, we're going to get to the Star Child and the latest updates on that in just a moment. But let me ask you, in talking sure. about all these folks that have a defective sheeple gene, is that a good thing for society, or is that not a good thing?
Well, it depends on which side of society you're standing on. If you're in the sheeple gene, you know, functional sheeple gene crowd, we're just nothing but a pain. Why? All we're doing is pointing out the flaws in the system, the things that aren't right, things that could be better, you know, on and on. We are sand in the gears of the smooth operation of the slave, you know, the slave and servant state that humans were created to be. So in that sense, we're trouble. But from our standpoint, from our side, you need people like us. You need scolds. You need prods. You need you need those who force the issues of making things change, of making things happen. And so it's good and it's bad on both sides of the issue, I think. It just depends on which side you happen to be born into. And the vast, vast majority are those who are born with the functioning, well-functioning sheeple gene.
All right. Well, let's talk about something definitely non-sheeple. And that is the Star Child skull. We do have new listeners all the time, Lloyd, every night. And a number of them, a fair number of them, are not only new to the show, they're new to this whole realm of information. We've got about 2.5 minutes here before we have to take a break. Can you give us a thumbnail history of what are we talking about, the Star Child skull, and where did it come from?
The Star Child skull is a real true bone skull. It's not a crystal skull. It is a bone skull, like your skull or my skull, that was found in Mexico at about 1930 and was recovered along with a human skull. And the person who found it assumed it was a deformity. And everyone that had possession of it up until 1998, from 1930 to 1998, believed that it was just some kind of human deformity. But it fell into the hands in late 1998 of a woman, a couple, Ray and Melanie Young of El Paso, Texas. But Melanie had been a neonatal nurse for a number of years, and she knew right away upon seeing it that it wasn't a typical human deformity. It wasn't really a deformity at all. It wasn't human as far as she could tell. It was different in so many ways as a human skull should be. It was just different everywhere. And it was too light. It was much too light. And so she thought, and also it looked like it had all the physical outlines of a gray alien. The heart-shaped face, you know, the expanded parietals at the top, the crease down the middle, the very sharpened and reduced lower face. And so she told her husband, Ray, I think this is the skull of a gray alien. And so, because they also belong to MUFON, I should mention that, Mutual UFO Network of El Paso. So you had just this incredible coincidence that the skull falls into the hands of a woman who is a neonatal nurse and belongs to MUFON. So she's knowledgeable about UFOs and she's knowledgeable about human deformity. And it's her judgment that it's not a human deformity or otherwise, and it's very likely the skull of an alien. And so that's how I got brought into it, as they began to try to determine what it was. They couldn't get any mainstream people to help them, and so they looked around in the world of alternative knowledge, and my name came up as a person who dealt with skulls in the work that I did with hominoids.
Okay. All right, we have to step away for a break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about this skull. It's called the Star Child skull. That's just a nickname that it's been given. And the question is it human? And if it is not, what the heck is it? We'll find out when we come back. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Lloyd Pye, and we've just begun talking about the Star Child skull. A fascinating, fascinating skull that was found, I believe Lloyd said, back in 1930 in Mexico, and has been the subject of much, much discussion and some debate over the years, but also has been subjected to some scientific testing. Let's talk about the debate and the discussion just a little bit before we move on, Lloyd. I remember over the years seeing on the internet articles that would appear that someone would post, Star Child skull debunked, or something about Lloyd Pye is all wrong about this and so forth. Do you get much of that anymore?
Oh, yeah, sure, all the time. The Star Child is a very high-profile target for mainstream critics and slugs and trolls and people who make it their job to make sure that everyone believes what the Sheeple Gene Program insists that they should believe, which is that science knows everything and there can be no mistakes and there's no such thing as UFOs and aliens because that's the official position. So the Star Child being what it is, it has a very high profile as far as those kinds of people going after it. In fact, this is really interesting. Wikipedia is the place that everybody goes to for information, pretty much. And when I first, when it, they, the, I and myself and the Star Child first went on Wikipedia, and I found how grossly bad they had distorted what was being written there, and tried to make changes. The changes, you know, to put the truth. I mean, even simple things, Kevin, like my own city of birth. They had all that wrong, you know, and you try to make changes and they would be changed back to the mistake. Mm-hmm. So I started trying to find out, you know, I mean, we're supposed to be able to make changes. It's the People's Encyclopedia and all that. So I started calling around and I got to somebody very high up in the food chain at Wikipedia. And I said, you know, you got all these things here that are wrong. I mean, it's just, you can't, what can we do to get this right at least? And the guy says, Mr. Pye, you are the last person in the world that any of us would expect to tell the truth about yourself. You know?
Really?
And so, I mean, I could see right then what we were up against. And over the years, it's
So he expected you would even lie about your city of birth.
Yeah, it just that nothing that would come out of my mouth, because I wasn't one of them. Mm-hmm. What you have to understand is that what everyone should understand is that Wikipedia is a tool of the mainstream. It is of, by, and for the mainstream. They say it's the people's encyclopedia, but that's not true. Mm-hmm. If you go in to read about horseshoeing, let's say, you're going to read something written by a guy who is a horseshoer, and you can pretty much count on what you're reading there. But if you're going to read anything at all about alternative science, then you're going to be reading nothing but a pack of lies, because it's going to be written by and for people whose job it is to protect the status quo. Now, I say this on interviews a lot, and people take up this challenge regularly, and they'll go in and they'll try to make changes just to see, and within an hour or two, there will be change. Now, here's why. Because anytime you have a very sensitive subject in the world of alternative knowledge, I'm not the only one. Star Child's not the only one. But I'm one of the main ones because the Star Child is so important. So what happened is people would, I would say that, and people would go in and change, and it would be changed back, and they couldn't understand. Well, the system is this, that with Wikipedia, they have what are called administrators. And those are usually just graduate students around the world who are buying into the system, buying into the mainstream system. And they're very, very defensive of it. And so they also have a lot of energy and they have a lot of free time on their hands. So somebody will take that on as a job, like the Star Child. I think we've had five over the years. And what happens is when any change is made to the Star Child page, there's an alert, a ding, a bell, a red light or something on the computer of the person who is in charge of it, and they just change it right back to what they want it to read. So I was saying this one day on a show, and a guy emailed me, and he says, look, I spend a lot of time on Wikipedia. I know a lot about it, and I know that they have a record-keeping system that is second to none, so I'm going to check out and just see if what you're saying is true. And then he wrote me back, and he said, you know, I checked it out, and I found out that there have been more changes over the years since the Star Child skull went on Wikipedia. There have been more changes back and forth, pro and con, between your supporters and your those who are against you, than on the page of ex-President George W. Bush. You know, now that's pretty good company as far as scoundrels go. So, I take it as a compliment that there are that many people who are fighting over the Star Child.
We've had very similar things. That, you know, this show is in this genre the longest running continual streaming talk show. Mm-hmm. We started back when this was embryonic, You couldn't even imagine doing what we're doing here tonight. And over the years, this show has pioneered several things that are now just commonplace in live streaming radio. And we three times have tried to have an article up on, I think you called it Wackypedia.
Yeah, I just refer to it as Wackypedia.
And it gets up there. Yeah. It gets up there. And it's there for a few hours, and then it's gone. just totally gone. I simply don't exist. This show does not exist as far as they're concerned. And, you know, I finally just said, well, who cares, you know? I mean,
I've asked them to take us down. You know, if you can't do the truth, why don't you just take it down and be done with it? Well, no, we need it up there to poke fun at it, basically, to show how stupid it is. Mm-hmm. Well, it's stupid in the way they construct it, but, you know, and it's not just Wikipedia, though, Kevin. It's all the articles that are out there that are written by, well, all the articles, not that many, but they're all referenced back to basically just one. There was an article written by a guy named Stephen Novella in 1999, and that article was based on the first DNA test, which was just a complete disaster and has been proven to be wildly wrong. In 1999, a test was done, carried out by a forensic dental lab at the University of British Columbia in Canada. And it was just wrong. The results were just wrong, but people believe it was the result that the mainstream wanted. And so the mainstream just absolutely wrapped their arms around that mistake and have just hugged it to their chest desperately ever since, to this moment, as you and I talk. You go and you will read on Wikipedia and elsewhere results from that 1999 test. Now, a test in 2003 completely obviated that test, just completely threw out the 99 test and showed that it was absolutely wrong, totally wrong. So when I started letting critics know and writing them and giving them the new results and saying, you know, this is what you need to post now because these are the new results and here's, it shows exactly why the 99 test was wrong, they would write back essentially and say, no, we're going to stick with the 99 test because we think that has a, you know, that's more likely to be right, even though everything you say about the 203 test, you know, is, you know, it looks good on paper, but we're not going to accept it because it's not what we want to hear. That's essentially what they would say and still do to this day. Now, both, I have to say, both the 99 test and the 2003 test have been completely obviated by the new tests that have been done since 2010, early part of 2010, simply because those tests in those early tests in 99 and 203 were done with primers. And primers were just small strings of base pairs strung together that didn't tell you very much at all about what you were dealing with. The so-called next generation technology, which came online in 2006, gives you everything really you need to know or you want to know about a genome, because it breaks DNA down base pair by base pair. It's the equivalent of looking at a building with 3 billion bricks in the case of humans, 3 billion bricks, and being able to take it apart brick by brick and tell you exactly where every brick goes and how every brick relates to every brick in every other skyscraper in the city. Mm-hmm. It's really, really amazing what the new technology can do. So that technology has the 99 test and the 203 test, for whatever you want to say about them, were done in the Stone Age, in the literal Stone Age of computer, of DNA recovery, because the new techniques are computerized at such a high level that the mistakes they used to make in interpreting, it's out of human hands. It's done by computers. They just don't make mistakes. So it's just a function of...
Well, for some reason, we just lost Lloyd Pye. I will try to get him back, but we'll see. I'm not surprised. considering what we're talking about. Not surprised at all. And we're going to try and continue with Lloyd in just a moment. At the moment, though, Lloyd was linked to us via Skype, and at the moment, that has just been cut. It's that connection just cut. It just went away. And now it's saying the call is failing. And so we'll give it just a couple of minutes here, and then we'll try it again. You know, the Star Child skull is important. It's really important. And it's important because Lloyd has persisted in pushing forward the idea that he wanted to have it scientifically tested. And he has. He has had it subjected to scientific tests a number of times now. And he was just about to tell us what's the deal there with the latest test, and our connection was just cut. Now, if you're new to this show, you need to understand that that's not unusual. It does happen, and when it happens, it's a little frustrating for us. But it does happen to this show not infrequently. It's not rare. And it happens frequently enough that I would have to say there's too much there for that to be a coincidence. Lloyd was about to say something that apparently somebody didn't want him to say. They didn't want you to hear it. We will get Lloyd back by one means or another, I think. And when we do, I want you to remember, just as if they put a yellow highlighter over everything he's about to tell you, I want you to remember that. I want you to remember that apparently somebody didn't want you to hear what he was about to say. But we're going to get it said, and we're going to get it broadcast, and people all over this world are going to hear it, just as they have heard what I think is interference from morons. Morons who hate freedom, and who hate freedom of speech, and thus they hate you. All right, we'll be back, hopefully without morons, right after this. We lost our connection with Lloyd Pye just before the break, and I said we'd try to get him back. I was unable to get him back on Skype at first, so I telephoned him, and he told me what had happened. And Lloyd, I'd like for you to just tell the audience what happened to you.
I think somebody just shut me down just to, you know, teach me a lesson or teach you a lesson. I don't know who they're trying to get at, but my computer, I was just sitting here looking, and just boom, it just said, it just shut down. I didn't touch anything. Nothing happened. So I assume that was just someone giving you or me a little tweak for maybe hitting a little too close to home. I don't know.
Oh, they're morons. You know, they've been doing that stuff to me for 12 years.
Things happen, you know.
They've been doing that stuff to me for 12 years. They need to get a clue. I won. I'm still here. and the show still grows. And every time they do this, my numbers go up. So thank you, morons. I appreciate it. All right. So you were about to tell us about this test in 2010 that, as you said, obviated the previous test. And you were telling us how detailed it is.
Yeah, the testing that they do now is, as I said, you recover every single base pair by base pair, so you can really tell amazing things about it, just incredible stuff. And all you need is small pieces to compare to what's in the database, because since 2006, when the next generation machines came online, there have been literally hundreds of species that have had their genomes typed this is from plant, bacteria, animal, you know, a lot of them. And what happens is because it's so expensive to do, this work is not cheap, obviously. And so you have to get government money to do it through the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. So when the NIH grants the money to do a sequence of a genome, what you owe back to them is the information that you recover. And so the genome, whatever plant or animal species or bacteria or whatever you've sequenced, you give it back to them and they put it all in one giant database. And that database now has literally millions and millions of what are called coherent base pair sequences. So when you get new DNA from you're doing something else and you want to see where it fits overall, you send it to the NIH database and they send you back what are called blast reports of where your fragments that you've recovered from shotgunning, where they fit. And so
what does that mean? What does that tell us?
Well, what it tells you is just what fits in the pattern of life on Earth and where it fits. So, for example, when our geneticist first recovered, the first recovery that he did back in early 2010, and in March, April, May, somewhere in there, and he sent and he recovered dozens, I mean literally dozens of fragments, about 30,000 base pairs worth of fragments. Very, very minuscule amount relative to the whole 3 billion, but nonetheless, enough to say something. And so he sent, and they were all from the junk DNA area of the nuclear genome. So those dozens went off to the NIH database to see where they fit, and about half of them had what are called human corollaries, meaning you could find stretches on the human genome that matched those fragments. And fragments we're talking about, Kevin, are 200, 300, 400, 600, 800. 1,000, 2,000 base pairs long, good length, you know, not like primers, which were 20 or 30 or at most 50 base pairs long. Primers were small by comparison to these fragments that the geneticist was recovering. So about half of them come back from the NIH saying you have human corollaries. Well, okay, that's good because everything does. Everything has that's on Earth has some human corollaries, pretty much. A chimp has 97% the same of its genome is the same as a human. A gorilla, 95% of its genome is the same as a human. A rat, 70% is the same. A mouse, 65%. A daffodils, 45%. Yeast, just common yeast, 20%. Everything shares the same life code. You with me?
Right.
So to say that it has a human corollary is not to say that it's human. It's more to say that it is of Earth, right?
Okay.
So the other half of those fragments that he sent off to the NIH came back saying no similarity found, meaning there were no fragments of anything that looked like what the star child was presenting. Couldn't be found. So not just saying it's not human, it's not here, you know. So what the geneticist said then, back in mid-2010, he said, you know, if this was five or six or seven or eight of these, even saying this, I could mark it off to, you know, some kind of aberration or some kind of, but acceptable. But to have it be half of what I've sent in, that is really special. You've really got something here. No way should that happen. So you've got something that has a large portion of it is not really exactly of earthly type origin. So from that result forward, Kevin, we've known that we were going to hit a home run with this thing. The question was how could we line it up so that the evidence would be so overwhelming that those conservative critics that we were talking about earlier just wouldn't be able to say anything. We'd just have to just sit there and swallow it. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to do, and that's the position that we're in as I talk to you now, because since that first group, that first cluster of sequences that were recovered, of fragments that were recovered and sequenced, he's collected a lot more. And the problem with the first ones was that they were all in the junk of the nuclear DNA. Now, everybody needs to understand there are two parts to DNA. In all of your cells except your red blood cells, and there are trillions of cells in your body, trillions. In all of them except the red blood cells, you have a nucleus that is in the center of the cell, whatever the shape of the cell happens to be, and they can be all kinds of shapes, but you have a nucleus, and then floating around outside the nucleus in cytoplasm, you have the cell wall, and within the between the nucleus and the cell wall, you have the cytoplasm, and floating around in that are anywhere from hundreds to thousands of what are called mitochondria, and the mitochondria are little power plants floating around out there. Now, they have, in humans, a very specific number, as they do in everybody, in all species. But in us, it's 16,569 base pairs. 16,569. You can have 70, you can have 68. You got things wrong with you if that happens. But if you're normal, you have 16,569. But in the nucleus, which is all of the DNA that comes to you from your parents, the 23 chromosomes from your mother and the 23 chromosomes from your father to make the 46 chromosomes of the human genome. In that, those 46 chromosomes are made up of about between 20 and 30,000 genes. Everybody knows that word, genes. And those 20 to 30,000 genes are made up of DNA, which is made up of base pairs. And those add up to a total of over 3 billion. 3 billion base pairs wadded up like a tight clump of rubber bands in that nucleus. And of that 3+ billion base pairs, about 95 to 97%, they're not sure, but in that range of 95 to 97% is what they call junk DNA. Now they are trying to call it non-coding or non-functional because junk is sort of derogatory, and it can't really be junk because we conserve it so highly. We keep making more of it. It's not junk. They don't know what it does, but it doesn't make proteins. The thing that makes us run is the proteins. That's only done by 3 to 5% of the whole genome. 90 to 150 million, 90 million to 150 million of the base pairs of the 3 billion. So it's enough to make things happen, obviously, but it's a small percentage of what's in there. Well, he kept getting pieces out of the junk, and that doesn't tell you anything. You need something out of the working parts so that you can compare, you know, to the working part of a human, and you can really make good comparisons when you get that. Well, with the mitochondrial DNA, the 16,569 base pairs, that's exactly the opposite. 95 to 97% of that works, has to work right. So the only place you can have variation there, the only place you can have mutation there, is in that small, narrow window of 3% to 5% that doesn't work. Whereas with the human genome, most of your mutations are going to take place in the junk, and they don't do a whole lot. The mutations that count are the ones in 3 to 5% of the working.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we will return right after this.
Goal for dummies. And I don't mean that pejoratively at all. It's just people who don't understand it or don't know enough about it and want to just learn the basics of the Star Child. Star Child Skull for Dummies on YouTube, 17 minutes, and that will fill you in on these arguments about cradle boarding, about hydrocephaly, about progeria, and show why none of that is true. These are just smoke screens that the mainstream puts up because they know they can get away with it. They know that whatever they say, people tend to believe. I mean, I was talking about the money a minute ago, and I've talked to several people, a dozen or so, who have the money to make it happen. And you sit with them and you talk to them and you explain all this, Kevin, you put the skull in their hands, you put the real skulls in their hands, and you just say, this is it. I mean, this is everything I'm telling you is true. All you have to do is get anybody that you trust to check it out. Go to the lab, talk to our geneticist, do anything we can satisfy any complaint you might, any concern you might have. And they'll go right out and we'll tell them, but don't go to Wikipedia and don't go on the internet because all you're going to read there are lies. And they go right out and they do that, and the next thing you know, they believe what they read on the internet over what they've seen with their own eyes, because they can't believe that science is so duplicitous and so crooked when it comes to dealing with things like this. They believe science, the science PR. They just believe it. And I'm finding that the hardest thing to overcome. You can't get them to believe you're telling the truth and that you're right over all of science saying that it's not true. It's a very, very hard nut to crack. I'm telling you, I've been at this for 14 years now, and I have nothing but profound respect for the quality of the public relations job that science does for itself by controlling everything about their message. The analogy that I use when I speak about it is I have to play a game in which I have to go to the hometown of the other team. I have to play in their stadium. The only people allowed in their stadium are their own supporters, their own cheerleaders. We've got to play the game on their field with their rules, with their equipment, and their referees. And yet we somehow have got to compete against that and win. Now, it sounds impossible, and in most cases it is. But with something as powerful as the Star Child and as powerful as DNA is in the world of science today, we get to run them through with their own sword. You know, the old line about you run them through with their own sword.
Yeah.
DNA is so well respected. It's so powerful. It's so well understood how it's the math of biology. I mean, that is what DNA is. It is the math of biology. 2 + 2 = 4. Each and every time, DNA says what it says. They can't argue with it. They know they can't argue with it. And we're just so blessed that the Star Child was buried in a mine tunnel. So it has suffered very little degradation, relatively speaking, over those 900 years. It has suffered the degradation that comes with long-term death. I mean, obviously, the bacteria of death are going to create a lot of contamination. There's a lot of breakdown in the structure of the fragments, the DNA fragments themselves. The analogy that I use is this, Kevin. You know that wad of rubber bands that I was talking about earlier that makes up the core of living DNA? Mm-hmm. If you and I wanted to get our genomes checked, we could get it done for $10,000. Our whole genomes, you and I, because it's alive. Because the machines can just undo the rubber bands and lay them out straight and measure all that's in them, and that's that. Well, the Star Child's DNA, as is all what's called ancient DNA, long-term dead over 50 years, those rubber bands have been put through a wood chipper till they're laying on the floor like pieces of glitter, and you've got to pick that up and put that together. You can do it. You can absolutely. Those computers can do it, but it takes time, and it takes money, a lot of money to get it done, but you can do it. So the Star Child has what it needs. If it was just a question of its physical differences, every single aspect of the Star Child skull is different than a human skull. Every single feature. You cannot find a feature on the human skull that is matched exactly in the Star Child skull. Not one. And the Star Child has three things about it that are absolutely unseen, absolutely unknown in any other species on Earth. Unknown. The fibers in the woven through the matrix of the bone, the red residue in the cancellous holes, and the lack of anion. You just don't see that anion on any other species here, and it has all of those.
All right, have to step away for a break. Lloyd, you were talking about three distinct differences between this Star Child skull and the human skulls.
But there's not exactly. There are 25 major and several minor physical differences, Kevin. This is important to understand. Physical differences. 25 major and several minor. Three things that are not found in any other species known on Earth.
Ah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And the things are, there are fibers that are woven through the matrix of the bone, and the bone itself, by the way, is made up of entirely of like tooth enamel. It isn't like bone. It's much, much harder. It's much thinner than human bone, but it's much harder than human bone because it has the same basic chemical structure of our tooth enamel. The hardest part of our bodies is our tooth enamel. So, you know, try to imagine that as a change. All the gene coding differences that have to go in to make that happen so that every inch of the bone is like tooth enamel. And then you have woven into that hard, hard, hard bone is a strengthening agent, these fibers that are like a rebar put through concrete. And they're there. You can see them. We've got pictures of them. You know, it's the kind of thing that science should have jumped on when we found this back in 202, 203. When we found these things, should have jumped all over 203. Should have jumped all over it and won't because this is not something that they want to deal with. Also, there is a red residue in the cancellous holes themselves of the bone. The cancellous holes are where your marrow goes. And when I say red residue and where the marrow is, people say, oh, it's just bone. It's bone marrow. Well, no. The residue itself is red, and bone marrow is just blood. So when blood oxidizes, it turns black. So if it were to be bone marrow, it would be black. But when you die, there are bacteria in your body that are going to scour out all the blood that's in you. They're going to eat it all up. And so every bit of the marrow in death normally for humans, when you find human bone and you open it up and you polish it, and you'll find not anything at all in the cancellous holes. They're absolutely sparkling clean, and we have pictures of all this. And yet the Star Child's got this red powdery residue kind of stuff in its cancellous holes, meaning that it's not human, it's not earthly, because nothing ate it up and should have. So there's something in the Star Child's blood or cancellous hole, you know, whatever the material was in its cancellous holes, it's not human blood, because the bacteria of death did not digest that part, and it doesn't oxidate because it's red. So these things are just incredible. Science should have jumped all over that one too. Just ignore it. What they tell me is that it doesn't matter how many physical differences the Star Child has. All they have to say, and this is true, all they have to say is nature can do anything. Nature can do anything. If we haven't seen it before, not a problem. Nature can do anything. It's just exactly like trying to argue with someone about religion. You throw anything at them, God can do anything. You can't make up an argument they can't refute with, God can do anything. And science uses the same trick by just turning God into nature. Nature is their God. Nature can do anything. And so I ran into this again and again and again. Lloyd, you're not going to win this. It doesn't matter how many of these things you stack up, how many of these physical differences. All we have to say is nature can do anything, and we win because we have the PhDs after our name, and what we say goes. You know, it's that game that I was talking to you about a minute ago where everything is stacked their way. The one thing they can't control, they can't dominate, is DNA. Again, the math of biology. And that's why we're so fortunate with the Star Child to not only have all these physical differences, which we could not win if that's all we had, but we have really nice, well-preserved DNA because it was buried in a mine tunnel, which is the equivalent of a climate-controlled storage locker. So it's just there. All we need is the money to go in and get it all, and we will get that money eventually. Somebody is going to find their cojones, step up and say, okay, all right, I'm ready. I want to know the answer to this. Let's do it. And then we'll be off to the races. That is going to happen. I can't tell you exactly when, but we keep piling up so much great partial evidence. It has to happen, I would think, fairly soon, maybe by the end of this year.
Well, I wish you great success with that. I hope it does. But let me ask this question.
Sure.
For me, my response is, okay, let's say that the final proof comes in and there's just no way out of it. This thing is absolutely, totally extraterrestrial. It's totally right. Alien.
Right.
Okay. For me, it's going to be, that's cool. Why would science, the sitting bulls of science.
I love that. Sitting bulls.
And like you know what sitting bulls do? They produce, never mind. Why would they have such a fear of this being proved?
Well, it's the same thing with Bigfoot or UFOs or aliens or anything. It's all the same thing. It eliminates Darwinian evolution from consideration anymore as the functioning factor of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. Evolution does not work. I mean, that the evidence for evolution is so paper thin. I mean, it isn't there. It just isn't there. What Darwin did was he took an obvious fact, which is called microevolution, which is changes in the parts of species, and he extrapolated a theory that said, well, if you can see these changes in parts of theories in a few thousand to tens of thousands of years, then you should be able to imagine that whole bodies can change over millions of years, and that's called macroevolution. So microevolution is what he saw, macroevolution is what he extrapolated. But he said, if you can't find the transitional species that are required by this theory, then the theory's got to be wrong. Well, it's been 150-something years now, and absolutely still no proven transitional species of anything, and they've been looking like crazy. Because it just doesn't work. Evolution doesn't work. But science clings to it so desperately because it's going to put creationists back in the game. Now, I'm not for that. I'm not a creationist. I'm not for at all bringing, you know, God into it. But I'm for bringing what I think is the truth, which is terraformers into it. I mean, something's out there that is the guiding hand for sure. But it isn't like the God of religion or any of that. But there is something out there that's running things at a much higher level than us. We're, you know, pond scum relative to that. But that's what we don't want to deal with. That's what we don't want to confront. That's what we don't want to face, is the end of scientific dominance over thought in the way that religion had to give up its dominance over thought to scientists. Scientists don't want to give up their dominance over thought to people like me. But that, you know, it's going to happen. But that's what they're fighting against. They don't want to lose Darwinian evolution because it is their bedrock. It is the bedrock of nearly all biological theory on this planet.
Well, it's a religion. It is a religion.
Yeah, it's science. Religion, yeah, that's just not going to change very much, except religion is going to have to expand the definition and the parameters of God. Catholic Church is already doing this, by the way. They've already said, okay, we accept that it's very likely. I think they did this in November of last year. They said, okay, we accept that it's likely that there's going to be proven to be other people out there, other beings out there. And when that happens, if that happens, we are just going to embrace them as brothers in Christ and try to convert them like they do and always have tried to do.
Yeah, so, but when I referred to religion, I was talking about Darwinian evolution is the religion of the sitting bulls of science. It's a religion because they're believing things when they can't prove those things. And that's called faith.
No, it's called dogma. That's called dogma.
Well, the belief is called faith.
Yeah, okay.
And that's exactly the same thing that religion does.
When faith is clung to in the face of contradictory evidence, that's dogma. That just becomes something that they're clinging to just because they don't want to relinquish it to anything else, including the truth. And that's where they are. Faith is, to me, a more, you don't have anything else, and so you have belief in something. You have faith in something. But yeah, when somebody shows you that that's wrong, and then you won't give it up, that becomes dogma, and that's where we are. I mean, science knows that evolution is wrong. They know it. I mean, if we know it, if we can read the articles and the criticism and all that of it that shows clearly that it's wrong, now all you got to do is read some of the writings of the intelligent designers who, yes, I admit, they are creationists in disguise, but that doesn't mean that their science is bad. Just because they're creationists by another name doesn't mean that their science is bad. It's very good. And all you have to do is read what they produce. Because why? Most of the intelligent designers are PhDs, are scientists who are just renegades within the family and don't subscribe to evolution and do what they can to show in very clear, I mean, overwhelming ways that evolution simply does not work, and it doesn't. And I'm totally on their side in that regard. I don't want us to go back to the dark ages where we have to believe everything in the Bible and all that. It's ridiculous. We need to look to the future. We need to create a new future belief system that is not based in religion and is not based in science, but is based in truth. What's the truth? The truth is that we are just members of a galactic community, and we're the poor relatives. I mean, we're not even good members. We're the equivalent of babies crawling around on the floor with dirty diapers. We have to get to the point where we can at least stand up and toddle along a little bit, and at least acknowledge that they're out there before we have any hope of them actually dealing with us on a reasonable, rational basis. Right now, we're the equivalent of lab rats. As long as we pretend they don't exist and pretend that we are the biological center of the universe, we're no different. We are no different than people were 500 years ago who insisted that Earth was the physical center of the universe, the absolute physical center of the universe. And everybody believed it. Everybody bought into that. When it was just dead wrong. Well, we're no different now, 500 years later, with this infantile belief that we are the biological center of the universe, when in fact we're just we're lab rats.
All right, we have to step away for break, and I want to leave everybody with this thought as we step away for the break. Is very much like living on the planet of the apes, where the great apes want to keep you out of the forbidden zone where the knowledge is. That's pretty much how this works. And, the knowledge in the forbidden zone in the planet of the apes was that, you know what? The apes had evolved after the humans, and the humans had been much, much smarter and more technically advanced than the apes. The apes didn't want their fellow apes to know that. The great apes didn't. And so the great apes kept them in darkness. Our great apes do the same. We'll be back. Got a question, Lloyd, that's a follow-up to the question that I asked earlier. The question that I asked earlier was, why do the sitting bulls of science want to keep this hidden from everybody? And we've talked about that. So now let me ask sort of a follow-up question. Assuming that things go as you think they will, and you're able to get the final proof that this is definitely alien, assuming that happens, so what? Now, by so what, I'm not minimalizing it or trivializing it. I'm asking, what changes can we expect? I mean, is it really going to shake these guys loose from their hold on reason, rationale, logic, and evidence, or are they just going to entrench and say that you're wrong?
Well, they may try to do that, but again, it's running them through with their own sword. If we can prove it with DNA, they just don't have anything to say, except they don't want it to be true. They could say that. Well, we really wish this wouldn't be. We wish you wouldn't listen to these people, you know, that kind of thing. But they can't make it not true. They can't change the data. That's the beauty of DNA. It reads out the same each time you do it. You might recall the horrible, horrible stink that was created in the late 80s when the mitochondrial DNA of humans was first being analyzed, and they were trying to determine, did we evolve from the common ancestor closer to 5 million years or closer to 8 million years? And the answer the geneticists came up with was neither of those, but only about 200,000 years. And it was just, I mean, horrible, horrible arguments and disputes between the geneticists and the anthropologists and the geologists who knew better, you know, who'd been dealing with what they considered facts for years of that common ancestor descent, which they still, by the way, cling to. That's what they still teach, even though it's clear that genetically we don't appear here on Earth until about 200,000 years ago. No, it's the same thing. You can't argue with the genetics. So the geneticists have won. Everybody accepts that that's an accurate figure now. And what the anthropologists and the geologists have had to come up with is they've had to make up what's called a genetic bottleneck to explain how all humans that existed before all got died down to just wiped out to just a few breeding pairs, and then we all sort of started up again at around 200,000 years ago. They just make something up so that they can still be right while the geneticists can still be right. So there's going to be some dancing around the facts like that where they'll try to figure out a way to make themselves look right, and they may even try to find ways to take credit for it, which they'll do that as well. No, they do. That's one of the things they do. They try to make it look like one of their own thought of it instead of some wild outlander like me. But nonetheless, however it goes in the end, they really can't dispute it, and it is going to change everything fundamentally in the same way that the people who moved, you know, in the 1500s, who moved us from the center of everything to where we really are, well, when the Wright brothers flew, that put us into the air when every expert in the 1900s, when they asked, they sent out a poll to every expert, is man ever going to fly? 95% said, no, the physics is all wrong, it'll never work. And there's these two bicycle mechanics in Dayton, Ohio that nobody consulted who were there doing it, you know, 3 years later they flew. Mm-hmm. So, and then you have, of course, going to the moon, that changed us to spacefaring people, and the Star Child is going to make us part of a galactic community. So it's a pretty big change, Kevin, and it's one of the biggest changes in human history. It's inevitable. It's coming. Look for it. It'll be here. It's just a matter of us getting our message in front of the right kind of person, which we struggle to do all the time. That's why I do these interviews. That's why I take tours like I just did to England. And you would think it would be a lot easier than it is, but it's much harder than it sounds, because rich people are very, like everyone else, really, really afraid of being made to look stupid or gullible on the world stage. And that's where this goes, on the world stage. So we've just got to find somebody who's got the curiosity, the courage, and the money. And when we find that person, we'll be off to the races. It's just a matter of time now. It's no longer a question of if this is going to happen. It's just a matter of when.
You mentioned earlier a couple of e-books. Where can people get those?
Oh, well, the Intervention Theory Essentials is through my personal website, which is lloydpye.com, LLOYDPYE. And that deals with intervention theory, human origins, hominoids, Bigfoot, the Abominable Snowman, like that. There's the whole other aspect of what I do. And then the Star Child Essentials ebook, that's available at the starchildproject.com website, starchildproject, all one word, .com. And both of them are inexpensive. They're easy to read and get through. They're heavily illustrated. They're ideal ebooks. That's what you want ebooks for, because they're like picture books almost. And the great thing is you can keep them up to date. That's the beauty of it. When you get one, you get the most up-to-date version with all the best information. So ebooks are a really good thing in that sense.
Now, are they in PDF format or Kindle format or?
Yep, whatever you need, they have them. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Lloyd, I think what you're doing is fantastic work, and I mean, there's every possibility that that wealthy individual with the courage and the curiosity is listening to the show, because we have folks around this world listening. And
you never know, and that day will be. It could be this day, but that day's coming.
How can that person get in touch with you?
I'm very easy to find. LloydPye@gmail.com. LloydPye@gmail. LloydPye at Gmail.
Fair enough. Well, man, I hope that that individual is listening and does respond, and you can get on with this and get it done. How much money do you need?
Well, we need in the low millions. Low millions, unfortunately. This is not inexpensive work. They can check it out. The numbers, we can show everything. We can show a need, why we need everything that we say and why we need it. And like I said, if they are interested, they can go to the lab, talk to the geneticist, bring their own geneticist, do whatever they want. We have absolutely nothing to hide. This is the real deal. And when you have the real deal, you can afford to do whatever it takes. And whatever it takes to satisfy their curiosity, we can do, I'm sure.
Good enough. Lloyd, if you will, stay on the line with me for a moment as I bring this flight of the Kevin Smith Show in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Lloyd Pye. And remember, there is LloydPye.com and the Star Child Project, or Star Child... What is it? Star Child Skull Project?
Nope, just StarChildProject.com. It's Star Child Skull Essentials is the ebook, and Intervention Theory Essentials is the ebook for the other material.
Outstanding. So be sure you go over there and check those out. And again, you know, if you are that wealthy individual that has the curiosity and the courage, and you want to put this one over the top and make it happen, get in touch with Lloyd, LloydPye@gmail.com.